question, man and consciousness come into the matter, and with them, the possibility of meaning. The chance-created picture may be beautiful or ugly, harmonious or discordant, rich or poor in content, well or ill-painted. These factors determine its artistic value, but they cannot satisfy the psychologist, often to the distress of the artist or of anyone who finds supreme satisfaction in the contemplation of form. The psychologist seeks further and tries to understand the secret code of chance arrangement, insofar as man can decipher it at all. The number and form of the objects thrown together at random by Arp raise as many questions as any detail of Ernst's fantastic footage. For the psychologist, they are symbols, and therefore they can not only be felt, but, up to a certain point, can also be interpreted. The apparent or actual retreat of man from many modern works of art, the lack of reflection, and the predominance of the unconscious over consciousness, offers critics frequent points of attack. They speak of pathological art, or compare it with pictures by the insane, for it is characteristic of psychosis that consciousness and the ego personality are submerged and drowned by floods of contents from the unconscious regions of the psyche. It is true that the comparison is not so odious today as it was even a generation ago. When Dr. Jung first pointed out a connection of this kind in his essay on Picasso, 1932, it provoked a storm of indignation. Today, the catalog of a well-known Zurich art gallery speaks of the almost schizophrenic obsession of a famous artist, and the German writer Rudolf Kastner described Georg Trakl as one of the greatest German poets, continuing, "There was something schizophrenic about him. It can be felt in his work. There is a touch of schizophrenia in it, too." Yes, Trakl is a great poet. It is now realized that a state of schizophrenia and the artistic vision are not mutually exclusive. To my mind, the famous experiments with mescaline and similar drugs have contributed to this change of attitude. These drugs create a condition accompanied by intense visions of colors and forms, not unlike schizophrenia. More than one artist of today has sought inspiration in such a drug. The retreat from reality. Franz Marc once said, "The art that is coming will give formal expression to our scientific conviction." This was a truly prophetic saying. We have traced the influence on artists of Freud's psychoanalysis and of the discovery or rediscovery of the unconscious in the early years of the 20th century. Another important point is the connection between modern art and the results of research in nuclear physics. To put it in simple, non-scientific terms, nuclear physics has robbed the basic units of matter of their absolute concreteness. It has made matter mysterious. Paradoxically, mass and energy, wave and particle, have proved to be interchangeable. The laws of cause and effect have become valid only up to a certain point. It does not matter at all that these relativities, discontinuities, and paradoxes hold good only on the margins of our world, only for the infinitely small, the atom, and the infinitely great, the cosmos. They have caused a revolutionary change in the concept of reality, for a new, totally different, and irrational reality has dawned behind the reality of our natural world, which is ruled by the laws of classical physics. Corresponding relativities and paradoxes were discovered in the domain of the psyche. Here, too, another world dawned on the margin of the world of consciousness, governed by new and hitherto unknown laws that are strangely akin to the laws of nuclear physics. The parallelism between nuclear physics and the psychology of the collective unconscious was often a subject of discussion between Jung and Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel Prize winner in physics. The space-time continuum of physics and the collective unconscious can be seen, so to speak, as the outer and inner aspects of one and the same reality behind appearances. The relationship between physics and psychology will be discussed by Dr. M. L. von Franz in her concluding essay. It is characteristic of this one world behind the worlds of physics and the psyche that its laws, processes, and contents are unimaginable. That is a fact of outstanding importance for the understanding of the art of our time. For the main subject of modern art is, in a certain sense, unimaginable too. Therefore, much modern art has become abstract. The great artists of this century have sought to give visible form to the life behind things, and so their works are a symbolic expression of a world behind consciousness, or indeed behind dreams, for dreams are only rarely non-figurative. Thus they point to the one reality, the one life, which seems to be the common background of the two domains of physical and psychic appearances. Only a few artists realized the connection between their form of expression and physics and psychology. Kandinsky is one of the masters who expressed the deep emotion he felt at the early discoveries of modern physical research. In my mind, the collapse of the atom was the collapse of the whole world. Suddenly, the stoutest walls fell. Everything turned unstable, insecure, and soft. I would not have been surprised if a stone had melted into thin air before my eyes. Science seemed to have been annihilated. What resulted from this disillusion was the artist's withdrawal from the realm of nature, from the populous foreground of things. It seemed, Kandinsky added, as if I saw art steadily disengaging itself from nature. This separation from the world of things happened more or less at the same time to other artists, too. Franz Marc wrote, "Have we not learned from 1,000 years of experience that things cease to speak the more we hold them up to the visual mirror of their appearance? Appearance is eternally flat." For Marc, the goal of art was to reveal unearthly life dwelling behind everything, to break the mirror of life so that we may look being in the face. Paul Klee wrote, "The artist does not ascribe to the natural form of appearance the same convincing significance as the realists who are his critics. He does not feel so intimately bound to that reality because he cannot see in the formal products of nature the essence of the creative process. He is more concerned with formative powers than with formal products." Piet Mondrian accused Cubism of not having pursued abstraction to its logical end, the expression of pure reality. That can only be attained by the creation of pure form, unconditioned by subjective feelings and ideas. Behind changing natural forms, there lies changeless pure reality. A great number of artists were seeking to get past appearances into the reality of the background, or the spirit in matter, by a transmutation of things through fantasy, surrealism, dream pictures, the use of chants, etc. The abstract artists, however, turned their backs on things. Their paintings contained no identifiable concrete objects. They were, in Mondrian's words, simply pure form. But it must be realized that what these artists were concerned with was something far greater than a problem of form and the distinction between concrete and abstract, figurative and non-figurative. Their goal was the center of life and things, their changeless background and an inward certitude. Art had become mysticism. The spirit in whose mystery art was submerged was an earthly spirit, which the medieval alchemists had called Mercurius. He is a symbol of the spirit that these artists divined or sought behind nature and things, behind the appearance of nature. Their mysticism was alien to Christianity, for that mercurial spirit is alien to a heavenly spirit. Indeed, it was Christianity's dark adversary that was forging its way in art. Here we begin to see the real historical and symbolic significance of modern art. Like the Hermetic movements in the Middle Ages, it must be understood as a mysticism of the spirit of earth, and therefore as an expression of our time compensatory to Christianity. No artist sensed this mystic background of art more clearly, or spoke of it with greater passion than Kandinsky. The importance of the great works of art of all time did not lie, in his eyes, on the surface, in externals, but in the root of all roots, in the mystical content of art. Therefore, he says, "The artist's eye should always be turned in upon his inner life, and his ear should be always alert for the voice of inward necessity. This is the only way of giving expression to what the mystic vision commands." Kandinsky called his pictures a spiritual expression of the cosmos, a music of the spheres, a harmony of colors and forms. Form, even if it is quite abstract and geometrical, has an inward clang. It is a spiritual being with effects that coincide absolutely with that form. The impact of the acute angle of a triangle on a circle is actually as overwhelming in effect as the finger of God touching the finger of Adam in Michelangelo. In 1914, Franz Marc wrote in his Aphorisms, "Matter is a thing that man can at best tolerate. He refuses to recognize it. The contemplation of the world has become the penetration of the world. There is no mystic who, in his moments of sublimest rapture, ever attained the perfect abstraction of modern thought, or took his soundings with a deeper plummet." Paul Klee, who may be regarded as the poet among modern painters, says, "It is the artist's mission to penetrate, as far as may be, toward that secret ground where primal law feeds growth. Which artist would not wish to dwell at the central organ of all motion in space-time, be it the brain or the heart of creation, from which all functions derive their life? In the womb of nature, in the primal ground of creation, where the secret key to all things lies hidden. Our beating heart drives us downward, far down to the primal ground. What is encountered on this journey must be taken most seriously when it is perfectly fused with the appropriate artistic means in visible form, because, as Klee adds, it is not a question of merely reproducing what is seen. The secretly perceived is made visible." Klee's work is rooted in that primal ground. "My hand is entirely the instrument of a more distant sphere. Nor is it my head that functions in my work. It is something else." In his work, the spirit of nature and the spirit of the unconscious became inseparable. They have drawn him and draw us, the onlookers, into their magic circle. Klee's work is the most complex expression, now poetic, now demonic, of the thonic spirit. Humor and bizarre ideas build a bridge from the realm of the dark underworld to the human world. The bond between his fantasy and the earth is the careful observation of the laws of nature and the love for all creatures. "For the artist," he once wrote, "the dialogue with nature is the conditio sine qua non of his work." A different expression of the hidden unconscious spirit can be found in one of the most notable of the younger abstract painters, Jackson Pollock, an American who was killed in a car accident when he was 44. His work has had a great influence on the younger artists of our time. In My Painting, he revealed that he painted in a kind of trance. "When I am in my painting, I am not aware of what I am doing. It is only after a sort of get-acquainted period that I see what I have been about. I have no fears about making changes, destroying the image, etc., because the painting has a life of its own. I try to let it come through. It is only when I lose contact with the painting that the result is a mess. Otherwise, there is pure harmony, an easy give and take, and the painting comes out well." Pollock's pictures, which were painted practically unconsciously, are charged with boundless emotional vehemence. In their lack of structure, they are almost chaotic, a glowing lava stream of colors, lines, planes, and points. They may be regarded as a parallel to what the alchemists called the massa confusa, the prima materia, or chaos, all ways of defining the precious prime matter of the alchemical process, the starting point of the quest for the essence of being. Pollock's pictures represent the nothing that is everything, that is, the unconscious itself. They seem to live in a time before the emergence of consciousness and being, or to be fantastic landscapes of a time after the extinction of consciousness and being. In the middle of our century, the purely abstract picture, without any regular order of forms and colors, has become the most frequent expression in painting. The deeper the dissolution of reality, the more the picture loses its symbolic content. The reason for this lies in the nature of the symbol and its function. The symbol is an object of the known world, hinting at something unknown. It is the known expressing the life and sense of the inexpressible. But in merely abstract paintings, the world of the known has completely vanished. Nothing is left to form a bridge to the unknown. On the other hand, these paintings reveal an unexpected background, a hidden sense. They often turn out to be more or less exact images of nature itself, showing an astounding similarity with the molecular structure of organic and inorganic elements of nature. This is a perplexing fact. Pure abstraction has become an image of concrete nature. But Jung may give us the key to understanding. "The deeper layers of the psyche," he has said, lose their individual uniqueness as they retreat farther and farther into darkness. Lower down, that is to say, as they approach the autonomous functional systems, they become increasingly collective until they are universalized and extinguished in the body's materiality, that is, in chemical substances. The body's carbon is simply carbon. Hence, at bottom, the psyche is simply world. A comparison of abstract paintings and microphotographs shows that utter abstraction of imaginative art has, in a secret and surprising way, become naturalistic, its subject being elements of matter. The great abstraction and the great realism which parted at the beginning of our century have come together again. We remember Kandinsky's words, "The poles open two paths, which both lead to one goal at the end." This goal, the point of union, is reached in modern abstract paintings, but it is attained completely unconsciously. The artist's intention plays no part in the process. This point leads to a most important fact about modern art. The artist is, as it were, not so free in his creative work as he may think he is. If his work is performed in a more or less unconscious way, it is controlled by laws of nature that on the deepest level correspond to the laws of the psyche, and vice versa. The great pioneers of modern art gave clearest expression to its true aims and to the depths from which the spirit rose that left its imprint on them. This point is important, though later artists who may have failed to realize it did not always plumb the same depths. Yet neither Kandinsky nor Klee nor any other of the early masters of modern painting was ever aware of the grave psychological danger he was undergoing with the mystical submersion in the thonic spirit and the primal ground of nature. That danger must now be explained. As a starting point, we may take another aspect of abstract art. The German writer Wilhelm Voringer interpreted abstract art as the expression of a metaphysical unease and anxiety that seemed to him to be more pronounced among northern peoples. As he explained, they suffer from reality. The naturalness of the southern peoples is denied to them, and they long for a super-real and super-sensual world to which they give expression in imaginative or abstract art. But as Sir Herbert Reed remarks in his concise history of modern art, metaphysical anxiety is no longer only Germanic and northern. It now characterizes the whole of the modern world. Reed quotes Klee, who wrote in his diary at the beginning of 1915, "The more horrifying this world becomes, as it is in these days, the more art becomes abstract, while a world at peace produces realistic art." To Franz Marc, abstraction offered a refuge from the evil and ugliness in this world. "Very early in life, I felt that man was ugly. The animals seemed to be more lovely and pure, yet